Hey, Bobby Manning here, and welcome to Dome Theory 63. Our guest today is Wes Goldberg. The West Side is his basketball website. He has covered Warriors, and now down in Miami covering the Heat. So we want to talk to him ahead of a matchup between the Celtics and Heat that obviously went in the Celtics' direction and pretty dominant way. Some of the things we talk about here, though, are still relevant. Marcus Smart's comments about the team's early start, players only meeting, and just general dysfunction and weird things going on in Boston that are hard to figure out and hard to put a hand on, and we'll continue to ask questions about going forward. I don't think one significant victory, and it is a significant victory over Miami, a really good Miami team to start this year, is going to change everything. So Wes had some good insight on just what the Celtics coaches thought of that team going into this year. The Heat, whether they're for real. I think we got a good look at that today about them at their worst on the offensive side of the floor in the half court. Kyle Lowry getting banged up and hasn't looked amazing to start this year. But overall, that group is rolling between Tyler Hero, Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo. They've built something nice, something extremely competitive, and something that's going to put them in the picture at the end of the year for the Eastern Conference crown, which is admirable given that, you know, they've signed Butler here, but otherwise they've brought up a lot of prospects on their own, got out of a lot of bad contracts over the years. What Miami's been able to do culture-wise and just roster-wise is pretty impressive. So I want to compare and contrast that to what's going on in Boston right now with Wes. He does the Locked On Heat podcast, he does the Locked On NBA podcast, and as we were talking today, finally got that Robert Sarver feature, and not the good feature, the bad one, the teardown of the Phoenix Suns majority owner, and the signs were out there that this was going to be coming. Suns proactively knocked a lot of it as untrue, put out a couple statements. ESPN, within the flow of this piece, talked about legal action getting thrown their way. And, you know, ESPN, know they've had some tough times over the last couple of years, but one thing they're prepared to roll with is probably some legal fights. And I think that they're going to be in a good standing on this one. Robert Sarver, racist, misogynistic, and just overall crude, uncomfortable sexual comments around the workplace. Just a whole bunch of stuff documented over the years by dozens and dozens of employees. And Lord knows employees, coaches, staff members have been flowing in and out of Phoenix over the last 10 plus years. They had one of the longer playoff droughts in NBA history, right up there with the Sacramento Kings. It finally ended this last year with Chris Paul's arrival, and there's a lot to shift through here. Certainly, I think the big question everybody's going to be asking is whether Sarver's going to be thrown out of his office. I think more so this is just a good showcase again of what a poor owner can do to a franchise. And we've seen it across a couple different franchises within the last decade or two here. The Clippers certainly undermined by a race-fixated and just all-around racist, bigoted owner who had ideas about people and how they could do their jobs and how they can function and let that dictate how he handled his basketball team. And I think a generally toxic workplace in Dallas when it came to accusations of sexual assault and just overall dysfunction in the Dallas organization showed itself to not be a conducive place to winning or just functioning as a top-tier organization over the last 10 or so years since they won their championship. I think Mark Cuban's leadership has really been put under the microscope and dissected and scrutinized in a way that finally makes you question after just accepting the bluster and the confidence and the bravado for years and years from an owner who had a lot of personality and a lot of ideas and a lot of things to say that, all right, maybe his handle on the organization behind the scenes and just the day-to-day employees wasn't strong, and that can be kind of a, you know, benchmark for your organization, just how people feel day-to-day working there and whether they can actually function and do their job well. And clearly, Sarver, doing the things that he did here, starting right away with using the N-word openly, numerous sources in this story, some unnamed, you could go, oh, the unnamed sources thing, but this piece starts off with Errol Watson, the Suns' head coach, through some tough years there, just being berated with the N-word in this meeting after a loss to the Warriors early in a season. As Sarver was quoting Green's use of it, Draymond Green's use of it, complaining about the use of it, but just using it openly, even as Watson told him not to, and saying why when Watson told him he can't use that word. And, you know, some of the depictions of just sexual language, especially around women employees here, and you know, there's just numerous levels, even stuff as silly as asking Taylor Griffin, Blake Griffin's brother, if he shaves his balls, was one of the anecdotes in the story. And of course, some of the stuff in here is more severe, some of the stuff is more ridiculous, but at the same time, this is a high-functioning owner of an organization, and Taylor Griffin actually looked back on it and said, yeah, he laughed then. Which was Sarver's defense, that Taylor Griffin laughed at that joke. But it's like, all right, you have this owner, this model of the franchise, this guy who's supposed to kind of be setting a tone for how things are functioning, and they're just passing around pictures and shouting the N-word through the halls and around, you know, black employees, and, you know, even just making commentary like we have with other owners here about how people can function in their jobs and relate to each other depending on who they are, you know. And it's just a baffling situation. I don't know how the NBA is going to be able to address this, because as has been talked about so far, they're launching an investigation into it. I don't know how much documentation there is in this case. Of course, as we saw with the John Gruden situation last week, emails on emails on emails documenting the proven use of just disparaging language, racist language, misogynistic, all this different stuff. I don't know what the kind of documentation is going to be on Sarver. And certainly, the league got a big helping hand from Donald Sterling's wife and the ruling through a court, and just some of the backdoor stuff that was done back then to essentially rule that Donald Sterling was incapable of leading the Clippers, and the wife ultimately took control and sold the franchise. That's how the league got Sterling out the door in this case, and I think there's going to be a strong case from employees and people in the Suns organization that maybe they don't want to work for him in this case, and maybe make his standing as owner untenable in this situation. I think that's what it's ultimately going to have to come to see Sarver sent out the door in this situation. That's not to lighten what's being said about him here, because we're going to continue to talk about him. We're going to continue to learn different things people went through working under Sarver, but it's pretty clear, and I think we're seeing again and again the distinction between a guy who doesn't understand the need for a functioning workplace to lend itself toward winning, and just his casual enjoyment of tossing around a word and just making jokes and doing things his way and ignoring how other people who are from maybe different backgrounds feel or respond to those things is pretty evident in the results that we've seen from Sarver over the years, right up to the point this offseason where we see him just completely unwilling to pay DeAndre Ayton. And there's certainly a big difference between some of the things he's accused in here, and making a personnel decision on a player, but the first semblance of winning that the Suns get in 10 years, the chance to invest in a core that made the NBA Finals and had a 2-0 lead over the Bucks. First chance he gets to commit his money to that and go in on winning. Doesn't seem all that important to him. And it looks like Ayton's run in Phoenix could be coming to an end just because they're cheaping out over a few million dollars on this center who was so incredible for Phoenix through their run. And, that's a personnel decision, something that they have to come to and decide on. But ultimately, it does follow a line of cheapness and certainly just character flaws as a leader here that we're seeing again and again from Robert Sarver. So what Phoenix as an organization is going to have to ask, and what people around the Suns are going to have to ask is, all right, maybe we can't force this guy out the door as a league, as the NBA, but do we really want this guy being owner anymore? And I think a pretty collective sweep of condemnation on the part of the key power players from the Suns. And that, of course, includes Chris Paul, director of the NBA Players Association. Get him out of here. And the Phoenix Suns would certainly be better for it. And as we saw in Minnesota, people are going to line up and pay the big bucks to take on an NBA franchise at this point and pay what it takes to keep Chris Paul, Mikal Bridges, DeAndre Ayton, and that NBA Finals core together. And they'll be better for not having Sarver in there with his lewd commentary in the rooms, just hanging over employees and people who, in droves, by the dozens, were clearly not cool with what was going on within the Phoenix Suns. Anyway, Wes Goldberg is with us today. It is Dome Theory 63. We'll have more in the coming weeks, I'm sure, on the Robert Sarver situation in Phoenix and everything that's going on there and around the sports world as well. Of course, good friend of the show, as always, is betonline.ag. Big reason we can do what we do here over at Dome Theory. We appreciate the good folks over at betonline.ag and their new website, their new mobile website as well. So easy to navigate. Basketball, you want the latest NBA lines? Can pull them right up on your left side here. The toggle between different games, futures, eventually series when we get to the basketball and hockey playoffs, NFL playoffs coming in January. All the way into February this year with that extra week in the NFL, which is pretty crazy. But got my lines here. Hornets plus 1.5 on the road against the Kings. I'm a fan of that one. Spurs only minus 3.5 at the Magic. I will take the Spurs in Orlando. Of course, you can already bet on Christmas Day games. Celtics 7-point underdogs against the Bucks. You want to get those points early? Feel good about where the Celtics are going to be in a month and a half? You can do that over on betonline.ag. And of course, this weekend's football games. Always, always fun betting the NFL games with the lines that they got over here. Texans, only 5.5-point underdogs against the Dolphins. We've seen how badly the Texans have lost in some games this year. Broncos, bigger underdogs against the Cowboys, who are just world beaters this year offensively. Minus 10 are the Cowboys. Got Ravens, Vikings this weekend. Love the Ravens and the things they're doing. That's probably a stay away game. But Patriots, only minus 3.5 against the Panthers, who may not even have their starting quarterback. That could be one of my locks this week. Got Bills, Jaguars, Bills minus 14.5 down in Jacksonville. Bengals, Browns, essentially a pick 'em. Vegas, minus 3 against the Giants. Chiefs, Packers, no Aaron Rodgers. Can the Chiefs cover by 7.5? Just so much action going on in the NFL this weekend, and you'll want to follow along on the number one spot for all basketball and football action. Head over to betonline.ag, sign up, and receive your 50% bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code, CLNS50, and receive your bonus. Basketball, football, NHL, boxing, UFC, it's all going on along with your favorite Vegas casino games. Don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers available for the 2021 season. BetOnline, fastest and easiest way to bet all your favorite sports. Of course, supporting Dome Theory and CLNS Media. Go check them out. Go get your 50% back. $100, $50 back. You'll be supporting CLNS, Dome Theory, The Garden Report, Celtics All Access, all the stuff we're doing this season. BetOnline, where the game starts. And here he is, Wes Goldberg, Locked On Heat, Locked On NBA. Talks of Celtics, Heat, Marcus Smart, Celtics dysfunction, all that stuff here on Dome Theory. Hey, Bobby Manning here. Good afternoon. It's Dome Theory. Quick check-in this afternoon on the Heat side as we get ready for Celtics Heat between a back-to-back here for the Celtics. Doing another opponent preview. Dive in here and look around the NBA as a whole because a lot of interesting stuff is going around the NBA right now outside of Boston. So that's kind of been the theme of the show to start this year. And to take us inside the Heat, he is Wes Goldberg, lead of the elite writer over at the West Side, his website, past with the Mercury News, Forbes, and also the host of Locked On Heat. So no one better to talk to about the Miami Heat today. Daunting task for the Celtics, especially with everything they got going on. Off the court right now, Adrian Wojnarowski breaking a players-only meeting. Marcus Smart's comments about what's going on with the Celtics on the floor after the meltdown against Chicago, and really just an overall disappointing start to the season at 3-5. The Heat were expected to be pretty good this season, Wes. They have been. I'm sure you and others probably had some promise for the Celtics this year. I think people had them somewhere between the play-in tournament and maybe a 3 seed at best is kind of the highest I saw. But have their disappointments stunned you at all? And what's been your general reaction to what's gone on in Boston to start this year?
Yeah, I was actually pretty high on the Celtics coming into the season. I like their offseason moves. I like the depth that they added. I like bringing back a guy like Horford. I thought a guy like Josh Richardson could really do something for them. I know that they dealt with some COVID-related issues in the preseason and in training camp, and they didn't have all of their guys available. But, you know, I thought that, the stage was set for Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown to take some even more substantial leaps than they already have in their careers. So, again, I was high on Boston. That has not been the case, and I have been a little surprised by how disoriented they looked earlier in the season. And, you know, Boston visited Miami during the preseason, and I was talking to one of the Celtics staffers, and they seemed pretty confident, too, about this team. And, you know, of course they are. They work for the team, but, usually you could sort of tell if the BS from the not BS and stuff like that. But they did say that because of some of the issues and some of the new changes and everything, that they thought that they could start off a little bit slow. So then I started to kind of rethink my expectations. And then when they did get off that slow start, I was like, oh, okay, that's what this guy was talking about. This made a little bit more sense. But what nobody expected was just sort of the interpersonal stuff, like the soap opera stuff going on with Marcus Smart saying that the two best players on the team don't want to pass the ball. Now you got the players only meetings and stuff like that. So this has gone from just, it sort of devolved from just starting slow to sort of, sort of a mess here early on. And I guess the big thing for Boston is how do you respond to that, right?
Yeah, tonight's a big night as part of that. You know, if you can get a win over the Heat, if you can beat a team that's been rolling the start this year and frankly has the best defense in the NBA out of all the teams I've watched so far, that'll go a long way, I think, in terms of making them feel good about each other. But we've seen over the last couple of years, they've gone on runs. They've won some big games here, there. They're Jason Tatum's 50-point performance in the postseason over the Nets, and just these different moments where you've seen flashes from them, and you know, players coming and going, and just all this different stuff happening around the team. And no matter like who's in there now, it's a new coach, it's a new GM. Lots of different things have changed year over year now. And this year so far almost seems like an extension of last year. And what you talk about with the coaches there expecting a slow start, maybe I think that goes toward like a defensive system that they've tried to implement that's been tough for some of the players to grasp so far. It's getting a little bit better. They've tried to get ball movement going at a higher rate, and they have. So I think Udoka and that staff have been pretty confident about the systems they have in place, kind of the mindset that they're putting into this team on the floor. But there's certain things that they've, and I've written about this over at CLNS, that they've defied them on too, whether it's, you know, no complaint in the refs. You still see complaint in the refs game in and game out, especially from Jason Tatum. You know, just different little things that he's asked them not to do that they've continued to go and do, you know, and just almost a dissatisfaction within the last couple of days too, that Marcus Smart took his comments public. It's hard to grasp what's going on the inside here for anybody, I feel like. And the most perplexing part is that the players don't seem to know themselves when you ask them what's going on. I know Kemba Walker got asked over the offseason, what's going on in Boston? And he's just like, I don't know. Like, that seems to be the common refrain you get here. I don't, when you have dysfunction going on like this inside the room, like, what kind of things do you look at?
Well, you look at the leaders first and foremost, right? You look at, and look, I think we oftentimes, when we talk about sports, not just the NBA, not just the Boston Celtics, you kind of look at best player and just say, okay, that's the leader. And that's not always the case, right? And I think it's clear right now that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are not the leaders in that locker room, right? And you
is
wonder,
there a
like,
leader in the locker room? That's a big question.
That would be, right? Like, I suppose Marcus Smart is the closest thing. I mean, he's probably got the loudest voice. And when I say that, he projects his voice the loudest and is probably the most, the guy who is most willing to be confrontational. But then you contrast that to something that's going on in Miami, and they seem to thrive with that confrontation, right? Jimmy Butler is a confrontational dude. We know this. That's kind of his brand. But in Minnesota, it didn't work. In Philadelphia, it didn't exactly work out. And in Miami, he kind of found a home for it. They bring in a guy who's equally confrontational in Kyle Lowry, right? And you bring him not as publicly as Jimmy Butler is, but with his own teammates, not afraid to look guys in the eye and say, you got to do better. And those guys have thrived with the Miami Heat and what they have put together. I don't know when things kind of got off the rails for Boston. I don't know if you could track it all the way back to the Kyrie Irving thing, because Tatum and Brown were so young in their career, specifically Tatum was so young in his career, that maybe like that wackiness of that Kyrie Irving stuff, that experience just kind of threw him off, and he never really knew how to kind of grasp that leadership, you know, straw. I don't know what it was, but they obviously this past offseason decided that they needed some new voices in that locker room. They made some roster changes, but they also, you know, Brad Stevens left his head coaching job. They went and hired a new head coach who was a little bit younger, you know, a little bit more with fresh ideas and things like that. And you thought, okay, maybe this is what they needed. They turned over the coaching staff as well. It just feels like none of that has really worked. And there is still, for some reason, a leadership void in that roster.
Well, I remember one of the first ideas that Ime introduced in training camp was captains. You know, that wasn't something they did under Brad Stevens. I guess the last one must have been Rajon Rondo in 2013 or 2014 when they were turning it over to Brad, and that just kind of held over, and they never named a new one. So he comes into the room this is when, like, the first real sign that something was off to me this season was Ime coming in saying, all right, we're going to name some captains in the press conference. And you know, he's like, all right, we'll name two. So it kind of became apparent when he said, all right, we have this team with two stars. We're going to name two captains. Who those captains were in mind, maybe to just kind of prop up Brown and Tatum's position and put that responsibility on them. And who comes up to the podium next but Marcus Smart? And he gets asked, of course, about the captain and just the idea in general. And he's like, oh, captains don't matter. We're all adults here. You know, we are all professionals. Everybody's got to kind of do their own leadership thing and do their job. And, you know, with captains, we don't need captains. And everybody else kind of followed that lead and just kind of knocked down that idea for Ime. And, you know, would captains have solved all this dysfunction and stuff like that? Probably not. Would it have done anything? Who knows? But for the team to just come out right away and shoot down that idea, to me, just spoke volumes about how, you know, for Tatum, he kind of agreed with Smart's sentiment that maybe captains don't matter all that much. For Brown, he just kind of punted it. He recommended that Al Horford become a captain for this team. So nobody just got excited about that. And did it matter? No. But there was a sentiment, there was an idea that Ime was trying to express there, and the team just never really grasped onto it. So, like, there's things he's implementing well on the court, but in terms of trying to build a culture in the room here with these personalities that he's been given, doesn't seem like he's just hitting the mark so far. And who right. knows, maybe nobody would be doing well. And maybe there's just something between the three stars on this team. And, you know, Smart does kind of look at himself as a star, and they've named him a pillar in this organization, and they've thrust up his role in the room just because of that voice that you mentioned.
Things well, you wonder too, I'm sorry to cut you off, but like the idea of naming a captain, is that just, was that in the PowerPoint presentation in Adoku's like interview for head coaching? Like, hey, I got an idea. Captains, you know, and then everybody was in the room was like, yeah, that's a really good idea. But it's like one of those things where you sort of try to implement it and then it doesn't work. And yeah, I get it. I understand, like, hey, Tatum, Brown, you're our leaders now. You know, Kemba Walker's not here. We've made a lot of changes. There's not a whole lot of vets. Yeah, we're bringing in Al Horford, but we need you guys to be that. But instead of giving them some sort of label, it's right. Like, you go into that locker room with 15 or 17 guys and you're like, yeah, these are our captains. And it doesn't really matter if you have a label or a patch on your jersey, or like in soccer, if you've got the armband or whatever it is, like, you got to be respected. You got to earn that. And if you're going to walk in with this PowerPoint presentation idea and be like, we're going to name captains, then it should be the people who have earned that. And you should probably take a poll of the players and be like, who do you think are the captains of this team? If you're really like that gung-ho about having a captain. The Marcus Smart thing is so interesting to me because we kind of keep talking about him, but it's like, is he, I think this is what Celtics fans are maybe worried about. Is he the problem, right? Because he's sort of subverting what Adoku is trying to implement here? Or is he more of a solution because he's calling out ideas that don't necessarily work? Is he nudging the Celtics organization in the right direction? Or is he keeping them from evolving and getting and creating that culture that they want to do? And I think that's a fundamental question that the Celtics have, maybe something that was addressed in that players only meeting.
Well, here's, I think, the root issue with Smart. I think it was good. I think it was refreshing for a guy to come out with something honest, something sincere from the heart that he feels is truly an issue with this team. I think the problem from the Jays' perspective and just within the team as a whole is the question of, all right, is Smart accountable in his own right? We haven't once heard anybody on the Celtics call out Smart for shooting 30% from the field to start this year, you know, launching 7 threes a night, shot selection, creation. He had 0 assists in the game where he called out the Jays for their late game playmaking and passing, which is just kind of a startling lack of introspection there, looking at where he's coming from with those comments and what he's doing. And, you know, he acknowledged in those comments there that he was shooting poorly to start the year. But, you know, Ime hasn't called him out the way he has the Jays. Nobody in the room has called him out through going through a sickness for a week like he did to start this year, kind of going through some ups and downs shooting-wise and production-wise to start this year. So I think, you know, just guessing what the Jays look at with Smart is, all right, you're on us all the time. You're on everybody in this room constantly. You're a tough voice. You're probably a needed voice in this room, but are you being held accountable for some of the things you do wrong night in and night out, some of the mistakes you make? I mean, last year, Smart caught a tip-off after like a loose ball. They did a tip-off at half court, and he just launched it from half court. The shot clock wasn't expiring. They had a full, fresh shot clock, and he just launched it over the basket. And like Kemba was just kind of looking at him sideways, like, what's going on? And Smart was kind of laughing it off at first, but like, once Kemba looked at him and was like, what the hell was that? Smart like got mad at him back, and they kind of had to hold Smart back. Smart's an extremely confident player. You know, you don't want a guy to be Ben Simmons and be passive.
Right.
But at some point, I think the players in this room look at Smart and say, like, all right, do you look at yourself as like an all-star here? Like, as an institutional player in this room, you're important, but, you know, like, how high can the ego go here when it comes to leadership? He's a leader for sure, but is he going too far in that sense?
Yeah, it's a really good question, right? And that's, I think, again, that's sort of the fundamental thing that they got to ask. Look, Marcus Smart does a lot of good things on the court, too. He's a great defender. He's, you know, in that respect, he doesn't really need the ball in his hands so much. And to his point, like, you want the ball in Tatum and Brown's hands, but I guess you want them to be a little bit more of playmakers. But let's also remember, like, Tatum is not a point guard. Brown is not a point guard. Marcus Smart is the point guard, right? It's that kind of stuff also takes time. You want provocateurs in that locker room. You want guys who can, you want somebody who can nudge teammates in the right direction, right? You think about what Draymond Green does for Golden State. Like, sometimes it doesn't go over so well, but it does ultimately achieve its Machiavellian kind of way, kind of gets you where you want to go. And sometimes you need those guys. But it just, for whatever reason, it just seems to be oil and water right now. I don't know if that's something that they can overcome. And I just think that right now the Celtics have been troubleshooting for this problem, this lack of cohesion, this whatever it is, the lack of chemistry, just not playing up to expectations. They've been trying to troubleshoot this with so many different things, and they have yet to really find what that solution is.
Yeah, and it's a million different things. They've lost so much talent since 2019, that year you mentioned. So, you know, people say, why'd they re-sign Smart? Why'd they extend him if this is the case? You didn't want to lose another player. It's like Irving, Horford, Morris, Rozier. Now Smart's out the door at the end of this year, and you're just left with the Jays in terms of real tangible talent. That would be a disaster for this group just in terms of asset management. So I didn't mind them doing that. But at the same time, lock Smart in through January. Can't make a trade. Can't trade the Jays. There's nothing real else you can do here with this roster. So they're just kind of stuck in this really awkward spot. And maybe doubling down wasn't the right move, but I didn't have any problem with it at the time. So we'll see where it goes. It's going to all have to come from within now. You'd love to see them be able to do a shakeup here, but it's just not in the cards in terms of what they have to work with right now. But I do want to talk about the Heat before this game tonight. They are just rolling to start this year. They made a move that I love, that I wanted the Celtics to take a long look at, but was just never there, and Kyle Lowry coming over. And, you know, adding to this culture that's been phenomenal in Miami for a couple of years. You can go back and forth on what the wins losses result has been with this group, but they made a 2020 finals run. Jimmy Butler's been sensational as the centerpiece of this roster for a couple of years now. Perfect move bringing him over from Philadelphia. And I just find the contrast between Boston's culture and Miami's culture so startling here, because like you talked about earlier in our conversation, like Jimmy's a guy who can be grading. We saw how it went in Minnesota. If the right players aren't there who can't accept it, like maybe Karl Towns and some of those other guys like Andrew Wiggins were there, it can be a disaster, and it was with the Timberwolves. But things have worked here in Miami. Bam Adebayo, different guys that they've had around Jimmy have just seemed to better fit him, and maybe he's tailor-made his personality a little bit better this time around to just not nudge guys and, you know, be so hard on young guys like Tyler Herro and everything else. So what has worked for in Miami for Jimmy Butler so far from your perspective?
I just think it was a good marriage, right? Like, all that stuff in Minnesota, all that stuff in Philadelphia, like, it kind of feels like Jimmy Butler was right the entire time. Let's think back to what his complaints were with those teams, is that they didn't work hard enough, that they didn't have an identity, that they didn't have a culture. And just specific to Philadelphia, you kind of see all of that unraveling right now with what they're going. And so was Jimmy Butler a jerk? Yeah, but he pointed out real, true things. And that's kind of what I was talking about in regards to Smart, is he pointing out real, true things that need to be addressed, or is he sort of just, you know, not being holding himself accountable and looking to blame others? Like, that's a fundamental problem. But Jimmy Butler, he's very accountable, right? He says all the time about what he's able to do better and all these things. He's almost too unselfish at times on the court, right? But that kind of goes part and parcel with his behavior, the way that he carries himself in that organization. And the Heat have always been a very accountable organization. And that matters, right? Like, that matters to players. It matters to coaches. You have a certain amount of consistency, obviously, with Pat Riley being there. You have people in that front office that have been moved up and in you know, getting promoted within positions within that organization. You've got Eric Spoelstra, who's been in place longer than any other head coach in the league outside of Greg Popovich. Like, that continuity, that chemistry, that everybody just is on the same page. There is a consistent mission statement throughout that organization. And that's that culture that matters. And I can tell you that's the same for the Heat. That's the same for the Golden State Warriors, a team that I covered for Bay Area News Group over the last 2 years. Like, there's just a consistent mission statement with these teams that tend to win. And that's what I think every organization is trying to strive to create. It doesn't have to be the same mission statement, right? Like, the thing in Golden State is sort of kumbaya, let's all get along. The thing in Miami is, you know, wake up at 3 a.m. and do suicides on the court. And whatever it is, everybody's on the same page, right? And that's what I just don't think is happening right now in Boston.
Yeah, and there's this mantra that you can't push guys that hard. You can't have these crazy practices in between games. And, you know, I remember back from that East Finals between these two teams, I'm talking about you strapping on the shin pads for practice and just like all this crazy stuff you hear about down there. And some people roll their eyes at it, but I actually think it's intriguing how the Heat have been able to just institute things that other teams don't even want to try with NBA veterans. And like when you look at this Heat culture thing, what sticks out about it to you? You mentioned 3 a.m. practices or whatever it is, like just the things that they do that make them different from any other team. Because now that they have the talent in place, I do think there's a real payout to some of those things they do.
Yeah, and you see it on the court. I mean, you look at the other night, I think it was in Dallas early on, and it was just clear that a guy like Bam Adebayo, who was obviously drafted to the Heat, only NBA team that he knows, but they fell in love with Bam because he has those values, that hardworking stuff that they talk about, that accountability, that willingness to be coached. Like, all of that stuff is what they are looking for when they're looking to draft or sign players or acquire players via trade, whatever it might be. And you know, he's out there. He's like got that. He's got such a quick, like, second jump. He's just hustling on the boards in an early season, like in the first 2 weeks of the season, in a way that I think takes other teams by surprise. And, you know, Dallas had like an 11-point lead earlier in that game, and they kind of put a lid on Miami's transition game that has been so good with Kyle Lowry and stuff like that. But the Heat just keep pushing at it, right? Like, they just keep going, and they keep forcing you to defend it. They keep forcing you to take away the offensive rebound. They keep forcing you to do it. They challenge you on every single possession. And that is what, to me, like, part of what that Heat culture really is, that they are going to just be the best conditioned team in the league, and you're just going to have to deal with that for 48 minutes. And if you're not close to their conditioning and you don't have talent that puts you way over the top against them, and they don't have an off shooting night, then good luck beating them, right? Like, that's sort of the deal. And we'll see how that works in the playoffs, but I think in the regular season, that's been a really good formula for them. That's part of it. The other thing that stands out, like, I think Heat culture gets talked about a lot. It is a talking point. You kind of put it in quotes with capital letters and stuff. Is it real? Is it not real? It's all this stuff. But I'll tell you this, talking to the players, they think it's real. So I don't know if it's real or not, but if they think it's real, that's really all that counts for the Heat, right? All they need is for those players to buy into it, real or not real. And they are. And I guess once you buy into it a little bit, it starts to become a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You just start to make it real, even if it was just a talking point. And that just goes along with, all right, we have a consistent message throughout. There's just, you hear that Heat culture drumbeat, you know, as long as you're around that organization. They talk about it so much, and they try to identify with it, and they wear it as a badge of honor. They know that, hey, we are the team that's dribbling basketballs loudly in a hotel room during the bubble. We are the team that are wearing shin pads. We are the team that's, you know, doing, you know, scrimmages at 3:30 in the morning on the top floor of the training facility. Like, they kind of weirdly get off on it, and they enjoy it. It's not for everybody. Not every player wants to come to Miami. They've lost out on a lot of players in free agency, a lot of players who just said, you know what? That's just not for me, dog. That's just not what I'm going to do. But there are players who buy into it, and when they do come here, they tend to play better.
Yeah, and Josh Richardson coming over was a guy who was there for a couple of years and talked about it in training camp here. Just about how different it is. Like, he said he'd never really been – he's been in a couple of different spots since then that – you know, even resembles that. And he did compare Celtics training camp to that experience just a little bit, not quite the same, but said there were some parallels that he saw just in terms of the intensity that was going on in camp there. But you haven't seen anything resembling the Heat's just attention to detail. And some of the things that stick out to me when I watch some of the Celtics, they just pounce on loose balls. The pace is incredible. Bam runs the floor about as good as any big man in the league. I think he's up there in fast break points period with just about anybody in the league to start this year. Their movement off the ball blows me away. Like, that is something the Celtics just can't generate at all, is the cutting, the movement Duncan Robinson does to get his shots free, and just the way everybody cuts. So Jimmy Butler really can just sit back and not shoot at all certain games. That's still my lasting memory of the 2020 East Finals there, is how he would not take any shots until the fourth quarter just to get other guys going. There's just such an aesthetic to this Heat team that stands out to me just in terms of the way they play defense, you know, hiding Tyler here, hiding Duncan Robinson with some of these zone looks. They are different. They're just a different kind of team aesthetically to me. And, you know, whether it's those zone looks, whether it's their pace, whether it's their movement, they do things that just no other team does to me. If you had to point out like one thing that you think just makes them unique as a group, what would it be?
They're opportunistic is sort of the word that I keep going back to, right? Like, they're not running a bunch of high pick and roll like Atlanta, right? They're not, and so many other teams in the league. They're not shooting a bunch of threes like every other team in the league. Their 3-point shooting is actually down, right? Like, I don't think that's happened in 10 years in the NBA where a team takes fewer threes than the year before. Like, that's just unheard of these days. You know, they get out and transition with Kyle Lowry, but their pace is just about average. I mean, that's better than what they were last year, second to slowest team in the league, but they're not like running like Charlotte is, right? They're not just sprinting down the court for 48 minutes. But they are opportunistic when it comes to pace, right? Kyle Lowry's got his eyes down the field like a good scrambling quarterback, and he's got a bunch of receivers sprinting down, knowing when they are able to leak out and get something easy. That doesn't happen every play, but it happens a half a dozen times a game, and the Heat get some easy points out of that. But for the most part, they're a half-court offense team. They're not taking a bunch of threes, but you know they're finding Bam Adebayo in the post. They're letting Jimmy Butler and Tyler Hero go into isolation. They're letting Kyle Lowry, where your point guard is a scoring point guard these days, to just get guys involved, and they're running all that off-ball screening stuff and things like that. But they're looking to hunt mismatches, right? They're not just looking to get three-pointers off. They're looking to specifically hunt mismatches, and wherever you take that shot, whatever, but just make sure you get it in a mismatch. And that's sort of what they do. So they pick and they probe and they do these things, and they get you into – they get defenses. Offensively, they get defenses into places that they don't want to be. Defensively, they're also opportunistic, right? Like, they're just going to be sound. They're going to switch. They're going to – you know, they got great defenders, one-on-one defenders, and Jimmy, P.J. Tucker, Lowry, Bam Adebayo, and all these things, and they feel very comfortable switching everything. But they're also going to jump passing lanes and create transition opportunities that way. It's just a team full of high IQ guys who are really opportunistic and kind of read the game moment to moment, right? They don't necessarily take what the game gives them, but they adjust to the game that's happening. They're not a team that walks in and says, we're taking 53s tonight, like those old Houston Rockets teams. They just play each game.
There's a fluidness to them for sure, especially in Butler, and he kind of leads by example in that sense, just in terms of how he's going to approach every game. It's not as rigid as I would even look at with the Jays, just in terms of how they approach every game. And they're much younger players. They're much earlier in their development. But there's no game where Tatum's going to take 7 shots and focus on passing the rest of the night. It's just they're always going to be looking to do it with their scoring. And I think that's something that they're going to have to grow in, as Smart pointed out there. How can we not talk about Tyler Hero? 22 points a game. Made his mark in the bubble, now a 40% three-point shooter to start this year. He can run the offense at times with the second unit. He can rebound even as a slender, smaller guy. He just does a little bit of everything, and I know all the gripes in Celtics land go back to missing him by one pick. Could they have traded up? Because the Celtics did like him. I know Ainge for a fact liked them, and they worked him out and all this different stuff, but they just missed him by one pick, and Celtics have been waiting for Romeo Langford to show anything at this point, and Hero's here. Maybe it's the most improved NBA player to start this year. Now, he struggled last year. They still found ways to get him minutes and different stuff, even through those struggles. And, you know, they were wondering if he was just a bubble guy nationally who just had that big bubble spurt like some other guys like TJ Warren did. But that hasn't been the case. He has stormed through the preseason. He's been as good as any player just in terms of year-to-year stat jumps this year. And it looks like, to me, there's no more clear front runner for that most improved player spot. So how did it go from high, low in year two, back up to new heights for him?
Yeah, most improved is interesting. That's not something I thought about. I kind of have him like penciled in as sixth man of the year right now, right?
Could you win both? Bench. I guess it's possible.
He could. Ja Morant might have something to say for that in Memphis because it just.
I think Ja's in the MVP race when we talk about crossover. It's true.
Yeah, if he wins MVP, then Hero gets most improved. Yeah. You just sort of have a domino effect. I think the thing with Tyler Hero is you look at what he did in the bubble, and that was just talent, skill, circumstance, whatever it was, a combination of all those things. Like Tyler Hero was a legit scorer, right? Like that's why he was a lottery pick in the first place. And then you saw that and the Heat needed that in the bubble and he stepped up. His second year,
not a bad one.
It was he slid back a little bit, but let's keep in mind, like, it was a pandemic season. The Heat had like 4 hours between the losing in the finals and then having to play another season. Like, there was just no off season for him. And I talked with him a little bit before the season, and I talked with his trainers, Drew Hanlon, who is, you know, a pretty famous skills trainer in the NBA, in NBA circles, who's worked with guys like Zach LaVine and Bradley Beal, like stud scorers, right? He linked up with Hero this past summer. This is the first time they ever worked together, and he helped him sort of craft his game for the first time since Hero was in college, right? Because that you're from college to your rookie year, you're getting drafted, you're dealing with the whirlwind of, you know, transitioning as, you know, in a work environment and all these things, not really working on your craft between, you know, your last year in college and going to the NBA. Obviously, he didn't have time to do it between his first year and his second year. This was his first real offseason to just work on stuff as an NBA player, and he did. He worked on his handle. He worked on his shiftiness. He's got that step back jumper in his bag now. Like, he just actually improved for the first time as a third year player. And I think you're seeing all that hard work starting to pay off early on.
Yeah, he's been incredible, and the Heat have been amazing. Do you see them as real title contenders here? Because you look, Brooklyn has struggled. Milwaukee has struggled so much that you almost look at this East standings right now, and I like the Heat, I like the Wizards, I like some of these other teams like the Knicks at the top, but you know there's probably going to be some regression back to the mean, and those top teams are going to rise to the top at some point here once we get 20 games in or so. I do think the Heat are right up there, though, maybe in that third, fourth spot right now. There's probably some half-court offensive concerns with them compared to the Giannis's and the Durant's and stuff like that, but I just can't help but think that this team's well-suited with their defensive four to compete in the playoffs this year. I guess the question's Kyle Lowry. What kind of Kyle Lowry are you going to get? Because it's been kind of a slow start for him.
Yeah, the last couple of games have been better for him. If he scored 22 or something like that against Dallas, 20-something against Memphis. So he's starting to, you know, open up a little bit offensively. But look, I think the Heat are legitimate contenders. I don't think that they're favorites. I think that they're third, somewhere right around there. I don't think that they're beating Milwaukee at full strength. I don't think they're beating Brooklyn at full strength if Kyrie Irving eventually comes back. That's the big wild card there. There's so much dysfunction happening with Brooklyn. There's, you know, Milwaukee, you know, the injuries catch up. It's really hard to repeat. We'll see what
happens.
They've
been really
there.
Bad to start this year.
Yeah, they don't look great. I don't know if that's just a sort of a hangover. I don't know what it is. I still have to, I agree with you, like 20 games in, we'll probably see them rise up to, like, they're not going to be. Not gonna be the fifth seed in the East, right? Like, it's the Milwaukee Bucks. They're gonna be one of the top two seeds probably when it's all said and done. Top three, they'll have home court. Yeah, I just think what you're seeing with Philadelphia, uncertainty that's happening with that comes inherently with young teams like Atlanta, even Boston, New York, these other teams. Like, all the Heat have done is given themselves a chance. Like, if the door swings open, and they might force that door open a little bit here, but they're giving themselves an opportunity. And I do think that the Heat are a team that could make a move come trade deadline, buyout season, stuff like that. They still have an open roster spot. I think for the right player, they would be willing to enter into the luxury tax and take that bite. But it's similar to the bubble year, right? Like, nobody was picking them to come out of the East, but they saw something at the deadline. They make big acquisitions at the deadline for Jay Crowder and Andre Iguodala, and those players really helped them get through Milwaukee, get through Boston in the playoffs, and then end up in the NBA Finals. That's all you can really do is give yourself a chance. And that's what they've done. And I think they've got a pretty good, I think their chances now are better than they were this time, the bubble year, right? It's just, and with so much weird stuff happening in the East, I think they're going to be in the mix. I think with the way that they play, they're going to have a pretty decent seed, barring injury, of course, but you could say that about any team. And like I said, I still think they have another move to make that could help those chances.
Do you see the Celtics getting it together?
I think so. I kind of always lean towards talent winning. Like, I think we over fetishize fit as a concept a little bit too much. I think we tend to, again, like, I kind of push back on the Heat culture stuff because I think it's just like a talking point, kind of a sports cliche. We over fetishize that too, even though, like I said, there is some sort of belief in the Heat organization. Whatever it is, it's working. But I just think that ultimately talent does work. Now, I don't think that the Celtics are ready to make a run in the finals. Like, that would be an insane. Like, I didn't think that they were ready for a run in the finals before the season, before all this stuff was happening. I just think they're probably a year away. But I think they'll still be a playoff team, and I think they'll avoid the play-in tournament. Like, I still got to believe that. And they'll be a tough first round. Like, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, those are not guys that you want to play in the playoffs. Their games are made for the postseason. So I do think that they'll get it together. But to what extent of, like, making a real run, I just don't think that they're that ready for that.
All right, he is Wes Goldberg. Great to welcome him to Dome Theory for the first time and a good conversation today. He'll be at Celtics Heat tonight, so make sure to follow along with him at WC Goldberg on Twitter, WCGOLDBERG. Westside, WesGoldberg.substack.com. Check that out. Locked on Heat, locked on NBA. Wes, great to meet you today. Enjoy the game. 7:30 tip off between these two teams. NBA TV should be a good one. And we'll talk to you later in the season, maybe if there's a playoff series or something between these two teams.
Let's do it. Thanks for having me, man.